Now the problem Machiavelli raised is this. Do we have in the 16th century a modern state? There were historians who thought so. The most important historian in the 19th century on the Renaissance, Jakob Burckhardt, entitled one of the chapters in his book, The State as a Work of Art. And he believed that in the Renaissance you had in these city-states a state which was indeed, as he put it then, a work of art. But modern scholarship no longer applies this kind of concept to the political states of the 16th century. For it is very doubtful that in the 16th century you as yet have ideas of nationality, ideas of patriotism, which were, as we would say, politically operative, which were powerful concepts, as ideas of nationality and patriotism are powerful concepts today. For in the 16th century, we are only slowly emerging from the feudal age, which didn't know anything of this nature, and we are only slowly moving into what we might call the modern nation state now. What does that mean? It means essentially that the king, the prince, the local lord, was still the focus of loyalty, just as he was the focus of power. The territories he ruled were still regarded as feudal principalities. What does that mean? It means they were his possessions. They were attached to him, to the lord, to the king, to the prince, rather than having, as it were, a life of their own as a nation or anything of that nature, rather than having an internal separate cohesion. For we must remember that the king and the lord also had religious sanction, that the king and many princes were anointed by the church, and that in this hierarchical society, several factors combined. Now, I'm not going to go into it again that it was a hierarchical society. I've told you twice now to look at the Elizabethan homily on obedience, which is, I think, extract 63, I'm not sure, in your Europe in Review, in this homily of obedience, which will make this quite clear to you. It was a hierarchy. Territories were still largely regarded, even by 1600, as a feudal fief. Two factors combined here, and they combined to change the matter. First of all, by 1500, the king had become, in parts of Europe, the most powerful lord of the territories. By the late Middle Ages, the kings had risen in the hierarchy, and they had risen by conquest, by marrying the daughters of other lords, by exploiting every part of the feudal structure so as to get territories in their control. And a man like the King of France, who in 1400 was just one lord among many lords in France, by 1500 he had become in effect the most powerful lord of France, that is, who held most territories through marriage, through conquest, through exploiting the feudal system. But secondly, the kings also, of course, against the other feudal lords, played on what we might call the religious angle. They played on the fact that it was generally accepted that anointment at coronation time gave the king special powers, and that it was generally accepted that royal blood gave special distinction in the hierarchy. Next to kings were the princes of royal blood, because it was in this kind of primitive society accepted that royal blood gave you special distinction. In this regard, it is useful for you to remember that until 1700, most European kings still touched for sickness, that as late as 1700 in England, Queen Anne touched against sickness, that was a regular thing, that a king through anointment was thought to have the power to cure disease, above all the disease of scrofula, called in fact the king's sickness, though syphilis was also thought to be cured. And that until 1700, every king who had been crowned had a regular afternoon in which he touched for the king's sickness, and the sick came to the royal court to be touched. There was therefore here not only a matter of hierarchy, but as yet a great deal of magic, a great deal of magic enshrined in the idea of kingship. The popular imagination fastened into that. Let me give you another illustration, a very striking one. The Dukes of Burgundy, about whom you will hear, who were kings in their realms, most powerful kings. The Dukes of Burgundy wanted to demonstrate at one point that their dukedom was solvent. How did they demonstrate that their dukedom was financially solvent? They imported 200,000 gold lions in chests, and they asked everybody to try to lift them. That's how solvent they were. You couldn't lift the chest. Now, this is still a rather primitive society, a kind of immediate society, if you like, and where the king and the monarch played a kind of immediate mystical role. The prestige was the ruler's, and increasingly so. Now, in theory, the ruler had long claimed to be absolute. As early as the 12th century, we hear, for example, that a ruler's wishes are law, which is Roman law theory. But this was a theory. But in the 16th century, theory was being transformed fairly rapidly into fact. Theory was being transformed into fact for territorial rulers. What accomplished this? Well, first of all, the putting down of the other lords. And you'll read about that through marriage, through conquest, and so on. But there's more than to it. What really accomplished it was the growing power of public officials. Now how? In the Middle Ages, every king had a council. That council was made up of the most powerful lords of the region. The council of the King of France would have the Duke of Normandy, the Duke of Burgundy, everybody who was powerful. And of course, the lords in the king's council were often more powerful than the king himself. They often owned greater lands than the king himself. So that the king's council was perhaps, in a sense, the most powerful body in any realm. Its members were great nobles. They had independent powers. They were, in a sense, independent of the king. But this now gradually begins to change. The rulers begin to fill their councils with other kinds of men, which contemporaries called new men who had no independent power, who were dependent on the king, and totally so. And these new men gradually became the king's intimate council. The big king's council existed and will continue to exist, but it'll have ever more a shadow existence. And as the king grows more powerful, the smaller council, what we call in England the Privy Council, that's where it comes from, the Privy Council will get the power. For these were gradually filled with new men who were royal officials. These were men increasingly of middle class backgrounds, so that they didn't have any ties in the localities. They were newly rich, and this had an advantage, because the rulers could use them and then behead them and confiscate the property. They were men who opposed the feudal interests. They wanted a national economic policy. They wanted a national coinage. They were even economically wedded to the king against the other great lords. We can summarize this by saying that is what is essential is that the state in the 16th century was to center on two poles: the power and prestige of the ruler, and secondly, the hierarchy of his own officers, in his own office. And you can say that from 1500 on, the people who did the actual administration of the king's domains, of the king's territories, were of bourgeois background, the majority of them. and the greater nobility was ever more pushed to the sideline. You can see what was happening very strikingly by the fact that the nobles now themselves aspired to become royal officers. That the big nobility, or much of the nobility of Europe in the 16th century, wanted to transform themselves into what? Into an aristocracy of high officials in the service of the crown. This explains something. It explains the change which came over much of the nobility in the 16th century. They got an appetite for education. They began to send their sons to the university. They began to see royal service as a new avenue towards power, where their old line power was rapidly being eroded. You can see that already in Castiglione, an extract of which you read in your source book in his Courtier. Learning is part of his equipment. And to be sure, there are here Renaissance influences involved. But here too, among the nobility itself, the military knight is being replaced by the royal civil servant. The knight was going out. He couldn't adjust, as you have read about it. Bankruptcy stared them in the face. For the plain truth was everywhere that lands could no longer suffice for sustenance. For the 16th century was the beginning of a 200-year-long inflation. That inflation, which meant that the nobility could no longer live off its land, just as the king could no longer live off his land, because there was inflation. Why? And here I must go back to something I've told you before. The inflation isn't merely due to the gold from the New World. Not at all. This didn't start till later. The inflation is due to the increase of population. It is due to the population pressure on the land, and that agricultural methods could not keep up with the pressure of population. They will never be able to keep up. That made for a great inflation, first in food prices, above all in food prices, but an inflation that then went throughout, as we would say, the whole economy. Now, what did that mean? It meant that the nobility was more and more dependent on the king, because he had other means of revenue. Patronage became important. And that meant that the king, hard-pressed, didn't pay his bureaucracy as we pay our bureaucracy. That was unknown. To be a civil servant was patronage. Patronage, for the offices were made lucrative. It is the same thing like the church selling its offices, simony, which you read about, and thereby the church getting revenues. So the king sold his offices and got revenues, for you sold your offices. You sold your offices. And if the officer had done well, he would be rewarded by gifts of land. But done well meant that he had reversed enough of his earnings into the royal coffer. Thus, the burden, of course, fell on the lower classes of the population. Officers went to the highest bidder. All royal offices were auctioned off, as we would say. They fell to the highest bidder. And who got it had to recompense himself and make a profit of his own then, on the people over whom he administered. The royal court, therefore, became the center of patronage and corruption. Patronage and corruption. There were exceptions. There were great and competent officials like Thomas Cromwell under Henry VIII. But that was the exception. The bill for this was paid by and large by the middle and lower class of the population. And the next century, the 17th century, will be full of revolts. Revolts in which, by and large, the peasant and the middle classes and the lower nobility acted jointly. Revolts which weren't for any kind of abstract freedom, but revolts against the tax collector, revolts against the bureaucracy. Most French revolts in the 17th century, whether peasant or other, were this kind of revolt, where the peasants were edged on by the small nobility. The peasants were edged on even by the middle classes to revolt against the tax collector and against the increasingly oppressive, in a sense, royal nobility. This bureaucracy worked. For it is nonsense to say that corruption doesn't work. Corruption can work excellently. And it did for nearly two centuries. For example, Queen Elizabeth of England's court was probably the most corrupt court in Europe. It worked, got things done. It worked, and it worked for a while extremely well. This matter of corruption and patronage, that I think must be said, so that it is not quite true that corruption never works. For all of this increased the ruler's power and stripped the nobility of its power. How? I think that should be quite clear to you, shouldn't it? The king had the patronage. The old nobility could no longer live on its lands. It gravitated to court and began to bid for high offices. For high offices meant, of course, enrichment. So that increased the king's power. But once they came into high offices, the king had a certain control, not total control, a certain control. The trouble is that these offices tended to become hereditary. In a semi-feudal society, everything tends to become hereditary, and we shall see the difficulty that really came up was that even this bureaucracy tended in its very nature to become a hereditary bureaucracy, provided you could pay the fees. Provided you could pay the fees. That was the problem. However, the great nobility did not lie down and take it all. On the contrary, the big nobility resented, of course, the growing centralization. And it is among that nobility that rebellions could always find sympathy. Rebellions among the other estates. It is among that nobility that the Calvinist revolutionary elite, which I talked to you about, found great sympathy. It is here that they joined with them through making possible the civil wars in France. But all estates or parliaments tended to join with the old line feudal nobility, because estates and parliaments were also opposed to centralization, were also opposed to bureaucracy. And so estates and parliaments, by and large, joined with the big nobility in the revolts of this and the next century. Indeed, to a large extent, the old estates became the weapons of the nobility to defeat the monarchy or to get a bigger part of the royal spoils. It was always very ambivalent, this use of parliaments and estates in the revolutions of the next century. Either it was to defeat the crown, you know, get back a kind of feudal system, or it was to get more spoils under the patronage and corruption system. At any rate, it has nothing to do with democracy at all. The estates and parliaments were not democratic. The three estates were not democratic at all. With that, it has very little to do. For indeed, the great rebellions, whether you think of the English Revolution in its beginning or the Fronde in France, the great rebellions which are coming up, or the French Civil War, the estates, by and large, considered themselves the guardians of the old feudal privileges, and therefore were at one with the nobles. It is the monarchy who centralizes and founds the state. Let me put it in your terms, something that you may know, because one can always assume you know Shakespeare. Richard III, is in Shakespeare a villain, right? Little hunchback, he says, law is in my breath, all these dreadful things. But Shakespeare, of course, was politically an arch-reactionary, as you know. He looked back to the feudal system. He looked back to a system before all this. So Richard III becomes the villain. But in reality, it is the Richard III's who were the great nation builders. It is in reality Shakespeare's view of Richard III, which is retrograde and feudal. It is Richard III who is, in a sense, the wave of the future in this regard. There were within this new system, of course, stresses. As I said, the officials themselves became so powerful as to become independent once more. This was handled very primitively by killing. When Wolsey became too powerful, when Cromwell in England became too powerful, a host of royal servants in Europe became too powerful, their heads were chopped off, and their fortune was confiscated. And you say, why did they become royal servants, if you know that the chopping block was at the other end? Because by becoming royal servants, you would not only get rich, but you could found a noble family yourself. This you would have, in a still feudal and dynastic idea, found difficult to resist. To found a royal family yourself, a noble family yourself, when you were nothing but of very low background. Wolsey's father was a butcher, for example, of very low background within the hierarchy. Now, there is a name we attach to what I have described, and that name is the dynastic age. The dynastic age stands in between feudalism and the modern state. Why do we call it the dynastic age? Because the center was the royal dynasty, the ruler and the family of royal blood. The territories were still thought of in feudal terms as fiefs. It is not until 1600 that a king addresses his subject as Frenchman. Before 1600, before the Civil War, no French king would have addressed his subject as Frenchman. He didn't think in national terms. He would have addressed them according to the dukedom or fiefdom of which they were part. If you look at the concept of frontiers, this has not yet emerged. Only in the next century will Cardinal Richelieu talk about the natural frontiers of France. National frontiers, which were also natural frontiers, didn't exist. Wars were fought still for dynastic reason. Remember that. The English quest for Calais was justified by the fact that Calais once was part of the ancient patrimony of Her Majesty. The wars of Louis XIV, about which you will read, were fought for feudal claims which Louis XIV thought he possessed. These wars of Louis XIV were, in international, in foreign policy terms, simply an extension of the kind of way he had worked within France, annexing territories, exploiting the feudal system. All this was just extended in the wars of Louis XIV, further and further, but still in the names of feudal rights, not in the names of national rights. This is the way conquests were justified. To quote again a Spanish variant of this: so ancient a patrimony of your majesty's ancient and hereditary estates. That is what you warred for. That is what you went to war for. For ancient patrimonies of your majesty's ancient and hereditary estates, feudal claims, not national claims. Once more, a dynastic idea, not for the good of the nation, but because these territories had once belonged to the dynasty, regardless to their location, language, or custom. And once the territories were united, there was little attempt to unify them in any meaningful way. Charles V didn't do it, nor did anybody else try to unify them. They remained diverse in language and indeed in everything else. Officials employed were not judged by citizenship. That was unknown. Officials were employed by criteria of ability, riches, or royal favor. Don't forget, for 20 years, the most important person in France was an Italian, Cardinal Mazarin. And I can duplicate that from any other country. Nationality and citizenship was unknown, and kings employed whomever they liked, whether it was an Italian to rule France or anything else that you might have. This was as yet unknown. But don't confuse that with weakness. because we believe today in centralization. Most 16th century governments could make themselves felt against rebellion. All rebellions were put down except the English Revolution. The rebellion of 1520 in Spain, the Pilgrimage of Grace in England in 1536, all these rebellions were, as a matter of fact, put down. So that you must not confuse this with weakness, because it wasn't. Now, dynastic age or not, kings and rulers wanted centralization. It is the religious conflict that gave them their chance, that gave them their chance, as you would say, to clamp down, to get more centralization. And especially, of course, in those countries where you have religious wars, especially in those countries. What you have is taking an opportunity to fight against the revolutionary parties, which especially Calvinism brought up. You could, in opposition to these revolutionary parties and the nobility and others who allied themselves with them, in opposition to them, you could abrogate evermore the feudal structure. You could evermore get centralization. And you also got emerging, for the first time, a feeling of nationality. Above all, on those who were Calvinists and who fought for the true religion of a country. You get the idea that England is a second Israel. You get the hymn, which I mentioned once before, to build Jerusalem on England's green and pleasant strand. You get a national consciousness emerging, but around religious righteousness rather than around any other kind of abstract idea. And you get it emerging as you get the greater centralization during the point of religious wars. That also must be clear. Now, what means then did kings use to get more centralization? First of all, they tried to tighten up the bureaucracy, and they tried to get common institutions, above all common institutions of religious uniformity. The first really common institutions they got because of the religious quarrel, and they exploited, were institutions which would make for religious conformity, which also meant political conformity. Because by and large, by the end of the century, the kings had gotten hold of the mechanism of the church. The great example of this, I don't have to tell you, is the Spanish Inquisition. The Spanish Inquisition, an old process. Every bishop since the primitive war, primitive church, had the right of inquisition into heresy. The foundations for the Inquisition, quite obvious and quite justifiable, in a religious atmosphere, come from, and I'll have you look it up, John 15:6. John chapter 15, verse 6, which is the quite justifiable thing for the Inquisition, because if you lived in this atmosphere, why shouldn't you kill somebody who killed your soul? If the soul is more important than your body, why shouldn't you kill somebody who killed your soul if you killed somebody who killed your body? Quite a logical reasoning underlay the Inquisition. But the Inquisition was really important because it was a part of the King's Council in Spain. Because it was really not an instrument of the Pope. He protested against it all the time. The Pope protested against it all in vain, the Spanish Inquisition. But the Inquisition was an instrument of the King's Council. And it was used by Ferdinand and Isabella. It was used against their enemies, against the lords, against the powerful nobles, against all who stood in their way. But together with the Inquisition, Spain pioneered in a second thing, which was easy for Spain, but explains to you why Spain became so powerful. In ideology, Spain had unity of ideology, the others didn't. Why? Two reasons. Why Spain could do what the rest of Europe didn't do, and got unity, meaningful unity, through what the Spaniards called unity of race and unity of blood. Why? 200 years of crusades against the Muslims, 200 years crusades against the infidel. Then in 1492, the expulsion of the Jews. Then the fact that the majority of the Jews converted to Christianity formally and intermarried with the big nobility, so that there was, in effect, no big Spanish noble who didn't have Jewish blood. It didn't exist. And so that you could use the excuse of purity of faith, of heresy, of the so-called new Christians, the Jews who had converted, of the new Christians, you could use that as the Inquisition to get rid of the powerful nobility, to confiscate their estates, and thereby to get unity, at least into Castile, but also to a great extent into Aragon, to get unity. So that Spain is a special case, but a special case which illustrates something very important. Because of Ferdinand and Isabella's shrewd juice of the Inquisition, because of Spain's past history, that heresy was frightening all over after 200 years of crusades against the Muslims. Because of heresy, Spain could get a kind of ideological unity which was not given to the rest of the European nations. Neither England nor France had it, the next big important nation states. And that meant two things: that Spain had a deeper unity in the end, though it was more split into Castile and Aragon, had a kind of unity which could become the base of Charles V and Philip II, which could become the base of what we call the Spanish predominance of Europe in the 16th century. And it meant also, and technically, that Spain had the best soldiers in Europe, for it had a long military tradition of forcing the Muslims out of Spain, of forcing the Muslims out in 300 years of crusades, finished, as you know, in the famous Battle of Seville in 1492, where the casting out of heretics from Spain was celebrated by the famous decree casting out the Jews. And the basis for that decree was something I've talked to you about before, the ritual murder accusation. But as there were so many conversions, as you have the new Christians, or as they will be called, Maranos, you have therefore an opportunity to unify the country, and unify it, as it turns out, more thoroughly. One race, one blood was the Spanish slogan long before moderns took it up. One race, one blood. One race, one blood. But it couldn't be a slogan anywhere else, and indeed it was not. So that Spain's greater unity made possible the age of Spanish predominance. But in the other nations, instead of one race, one blood, the rulers began to stress certain things. They began to stress, quite logically from what I have said, their divinity. They began to heighten their divinity at the coronation, when they are anointed here with the holy oil. They began to stress what we call the divine right of kings, that kings are mortal gods, that they should have control over the church, that they are fleshy gods, as James I put it a little later, that indeed the king cannot be contradicted, that indeed the king must make the laws, for he is from God. Monarchs hard-pressed like Queen Elizabeth got a tremendous propaganda machine going. Hell, most of the things you read in English literature were produced by an Elizabethan propaganda machine, financed by Burley, Spencer's Fairy Queen, or many of these plays that you read as literature these days were really product of a tremendous Elizabethan propaganda machine. She was, as you will see, at best a second-rate monarch who failed. But that's not how she got on, you see, because her propaganda was enshrined in English departments. So she's had a very good press. She's had a very good press, even if she was, as we now all know, at best a second-rate monarch. But that's neither here nor there. This is the propaganda machine divine Elizabeth, the fairy queen, all that sort of stuff was, of course, meant to exalt her power, to exalt her power. And everywhere under the religious wars, the divine right of kings then comes in this kind of surface. It becomes an important step, a closing of ranks by the dynasts against the old nobility, against the estates, and against the Calvinist revolutionary elite. Against these three enemies, get this right, the old nobility, the Calvinist revolutionary parties, against these enemies and the church in a certain sense, as long as it was independent and looked to Rome, but that, as you will see, will soon end, as long as it looked to Rome, the Catholic Church by and large. These three enemies were countered by the divine right of kings, were countered by the dynasts, by this exaltation. And if you ever go to London, you must go to the banqueting hall in Whitehall, which is the last that stands from the 17th century palace. And on its ceiling you will see the apotheosis of King James I in England, where King James I is actually floating on a cloud, touching hands with God. And that was painted by his son Charles I very soon before he was going to have his head chopped off by a Calvinist revolutionary elite. But it is a Rubens, it's a Rubens portrait, a Rubens painting. But this is the divine right of kings. Now, finally, in all of this, then, you have the following. You have, first of all, the dynastic age in all that it means. As much medieval as modern, the new never comes freshly blown like Venus from a shell. You know that. If you do, you should. You have, in a sense here, the new and the old coexisting, as it always does. One wonders what's the new these days, but I'm sure they coexist. The new and the old coexist, as it always does. You have, secondly, however, the monarchs making the effort to centralize still more, as I have said. To centralize still more. And finally, this comes to a crisis in the age of religious wars, when they face not only the old nobility, the church, but also revolutionary parties. What will be the outcome of the crisis? Shall I tell you? Well, I'll tell you. The outcome of the crisis, about which we will talk very long, is, of course, the man who won were the dynasts. But in winning, they brought something else new ahead, which was to defeat them in turn, namely the idea of the nation. The idea of the nation comes through the religious wars. And though the dynasts won the religious wars in many places, especially in England, in France, and so on, against the Calvinist revolutionary parties, more often than not, what really won in the end is a new concept of the nation. A new concept of the nation, the modern concept of the nation, which will in its turn liquidate the dynastic age. So you can see the rhythm of history in a way. The old and new coexist, and the new comes up. Man, in a way, is what Hegel called a subject, an object of the cunning of reason. The new that comes up often defeats the victors, and that is here as well. And yet, as we look at the 16th century in general, what do we find? We find not only monarchs, but empires. Three big empires. The empire of Charles V, the empire of the Turks, and the empire of Muscovy. The three great empires, which yet, in a sense, dominate the century. What do we not find, really? Republics. Republics? Republics? Only one. Switzerland. The only republic. Nobody dared attack it. It had the best soldiers in Europe, apart from Spain. It just defeated the Duke of Burgundy by 1500. And how were you going to invade the Alpine valleys? Switzerland. And then the second republican experiment, the Netherlands. But that was already a modified republic. And perhaps I should add a third, as I'm adding, Venice. Venice, perhaps most influential on those who wanted a republic, the Venetian Republic, a large empire itself, as you know, looking at the map, if you do look at maps, Venice, a large empire itself, so that there were only these republics. Everything else was monarchy and empires, and it is the empires which still play a meaningful role, for after all, Charles I's empire was the heartland of Europe, and Charles's empire was itself typical of the dynastic age. Charles never fought for it. He inherited it. He inherited it. And please look carefully at Charles' inheritance in the table in your Europe in Review. That's another thing I can't teach you with any creativity. It's another thing you will damn well just have to learn. Charles' inheritance, because that is not that is a creativity, but of a different sense than you mean, I think. He inherited three quarters of the territory, which he ruled. A very dynastic thing to do. He didn't speak the language of any major territory he ruled. Typical. He spoke only Dutch with ease, and that was the smallest of his territories. Never spoke Spanish very well. Never spoke any of the other multitudinous languages at all. His chief advisors came from everywhere, including from France, the nation he fought most of his career. But as I say, citizenship didn't really count. Ability and royal friendship counts. And his friendship was given to a Frenchman who became one of the most influential. Again, there he illustrates it. Charles V was a foreigner, even in Spain, upon which he eventually relied so much and which became the base of his own power. Again, there you can see what the dynastic age meant, that the modern nation state was not yet there, that we are still in a transition from feudalism, and that we have not yet liquidated it, if it ever will be liquidated entirely. Now, all the things we've talked about, the Reformation, the Catholic Reformation, the rise of the nation state in its 16th century phase, all of these played against the background of empire, the background of the last great peaceful empire. For Charles V is the last time in Europe that anybody is going to rule most of Europe peacefully and without aggression. Aggression as we define it, and not to rule it on bayonets. And so we must now finally, before we come to the religious wars, come to the empire of Charles V itself. A very important thing, of course, not only then, but also in itself for the future. And to that we must come then next time.